Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. On the show today, Alice Bryant has a report about Mount Everest. Jill Robbins brings us Ask a Teacher. And we close the show with an American story. Today, we hear The Story of an Eyewitness by Jack London. But first, 8 young superspellers beat the dictionary to share victory at the 92nd Scripps National Spelling Bee. The final part of the historic bee began on Thursday night with 16 spellers remaining. After almost 4 hours and 17 rounds of spelling, 8 competitors still remained. In most years, a single competitor wins much earlier in the night. There were so many strong spellers still remaining that bee officials began worrying that they did not have enough difficult words left to ask them. So, at the end of round 17, longtime bee pronouncer Jacques Bailey announced, "Champion spellers, we are now in uncharted territory. We do have plenty of words remaining on our list, but we will soon run out of words that will possibly challenge you, the most phenomenal collection of superspellers in the history of this competition." Bailey then explained that all spellers still standing after the 20th round would be named co-champions.
By the end of round 20, all 8 still remained. The happy group created their own word for their joint success, Octochamps. Each will receive a $50,000 prize. The competition started on Tuesday with 562 spellers from across the nation, U.S. territories, and 6 other countries: the Bahamas, Canada, Ghana, Jamaica, Japan, and South Korea. Officials say that while there have been co-winners in the past, there has never been as many as 8. The crowd reacted wildly as each competitor stepped forward and successfully spelled their word in the final round. The winners are 6 boys and 2 girls, all between the ages of 12 and 14.
Rashik Gandhasri is 13 years old and from California. His final word? Auslaut, a German-based word that means the final sound in a word or syllable. He held his hands up and smiled after spelling it correctly. He was the first speller to become a champion. Next was Aaron Howard, who is 14 and from Alabama. She did not hide the fact that she knew exactly how to spell her very last word, erysipelas. She put her hands to her mouth, took a deep breath, and then easily spelled the Greek-based word. She started to cry as her family cheered her on. 13-year-old Saketh Sundar from Maryland stayed calm as he correctly spelled bougainvillea to become the 3rd winner of the night. As the crowd cheered and shouted, the final spellers stayed serious. 13-year-old Shruthika Padhi of New Jersey asked Bailey to pronounce her final word, aiguillette, several times before being confirmed winner number four. Texan Sohum Sukhatankar, also 13, pumped one hand in the air after easily spelling Pandalak.
Winner number six was 12-year-old Abhijay Kodali, the youngest of the Octo Champs. He spelled Palama correctly before returning to his seat and nearly collapsing from happiness. He became Texas's second champion of the night. Seventh was 13-year-old Christopher Sorau of New Jersey, with the word sernuous. The eighth and final speller of the extremely long night was Rohan Raja. The 13-year-old, also from Texas, moved his body from side to side as he waited for Bailey to announce his word, odilic. Odilic, Raja repeated. Okay. The crowd reacted to his quiet trust and belief in himself. Not surprisingly, Raja became the eighth and final winner of the historic night. The seven other champions gave him high fives and hugs. On Friday morning, the Octo Champs appeared together on the American morning news program, The Today Show. A reporter asked the group if anyone would have wanted to continue the competition in order to have one clear winner. Christopher Sorau answered for the group, "I think we were all sleepy, and also we all wanted to win together," he said. "We were competing together, and we were really happy when one person spelled their word correctly." I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver. That's CatyWeaver.
That is correct.
A Nepalese official says that it is time to examine the rules on who is permitted to climb Mount Everest, the world's tallest mountain. Yagya Raj Sunuar told the New York Times this week it's time to review all the old laws. The parliament member's comment comes after the deaths of at least 11 climbers this year. Climbing Everest has been a dream for many people ever since Edmund Hillary and his guide Tenzing Norgay reached the top of the mountain in 1953. Nepal is one of the world's poorest countries. The climbing industry brings in $300 million each year. Officials do not limit the number of permits the country issues to climbers. This year, the government of Nepal issued Everest permits to 381 people, the highest number ever. Anyone can get a permit for an $11,000 fee. A picture taken on May 22nd shows a long line of climbers wearing colorful winter clothes as they make their way up the mountain. The climbers are standing on a snow-covered ridge with a 2,000-meter drop on either side. They are hanging on to a single line of rope. "There were more people on Everest than there should be," said Kul Bahadur Gurung, the general secretary of the Nepal Mountaineering Association. He added, "We lack the rules that say how many people can actually go up and when." At one time, only experienced mountaineers tried to climb Everest. But the cost of such an effort has decreased. This has led more and more inexperienced climbers to try to reach the top of Everest. Nepal only requires that climbers have a note from a medical doctor saying they are physically fit. Climbers do not have to prove they have the strength or ability to perform at extreme heights. The number of climbers who have died this season is the highest since 2015. Most of those who died are believed to have suffered from altitude sickness. The condition is caused by low amounts of oxygen in extremely high places. It can lead to severe headaches, stomach sickness, shortness of breath, and mental confusion. Because of the altitude, climbers have just hours to reach the top before they are at risk of having their lungs fill with liquid. The area between Camp 4, 8,000 meters, and the top of Everest, 8,850 meters, is known as the death zone. When a climber dies in this zone, his or her body is left there. It would be too dangerous for another climber to spend their energy bringing the body down the mountain. Eric Murphy made his third climb on Everest this year. He told the Associated Press, "Every minute counts there." He said some tired climbers, with no one to help them, could take 17 hours instead of 12 to reach the top. For inexperienced climbers, that is enough to have a profound effect. Among those who have died at Everest this year is American Christopher Coolish. He was from the state of Colorado. Coolish died on his way down, shortly after reaching the top. Just before he died, Coolish made it into the so-called Seven Summit Club of mountaineers who have reached the highest peaks on every continent, his brother said. Mohan Krishna Sapkota is secretary of Nepal's Ministry of Tourism and Civil Aviation. He blamed the weather, equipment, and lack of oxygen for this year's deaths. However, he added, in the next season, we will work to have double rope in the area below the summit so there is better management of the flow of climbers. Mirza Ali is a Pakistani mountaineer and tour operator who reached Everest's peak for the first time this month. It was his fourth time trying. He said, "Everybody wants to stand on top of the world." But, he said, visitors who are unprepared for the extremes of Everest harm the mountaineering industry. Ali added, "The more people come, the more permits, more business. But, on the other side of it, is a lot of risk because it is costing lives." I'm Alice Bryant.
This week, we answer a question we received in an email last week from Mohammed from Iran. He writes, "I get confused by the meanings of the verb deal with. Please explain about it, if it is possible." Dear Mohammed, great question. Let's deal with it right away. The verb you asked about is what we call a phrasal verb. We also call them two-part verbs, or even three-part verbs. They contain a verb, an adverb, and at times, a preposition. One meaning of deal with is to take action or do something. We often use deal with when talking about solving a problem, For example, let's say someone forgot to close the office window before a rainstorm hit. Listen.
Rain came in through that window. Can you deal with it?
Sure. I'll get a towel and dry it.
The second person dealt with the problem by cleaning up the water and hopefully closing the window. We can also use deal with in relation to buying or selling goods or services.
This phone doesn't work, and I just bought it last week.
I've dealt with that company before. I'm sure they'll give you a new one.
We also use deal with when talking about the subject of a report, film, book, and other things.
The report deals with the problem of poverty among children.
Stephen Hawking's work dealt with time and the universe.
The next time you hear or read the verb deal with, look at the words around it and decide if the meaning is one of these. Take action, trade with, be about. If you want to learn more about verbs like deal with, search for phrasal verbs in our Everyday Grammar TV series. I'm Jill Robbins.
Not in history has a modern city been so completely destroyed. San Francisco is gone. Nothing remains of it but memories and a few homes that were near the edge of the city. Its industrial area is gone. Its business area is gone. Its social and living areas are gone. The factories, great stores and newspaper buildings, the hotels, and the huge homes of the very rich are all gone. Within minutes of the earthquake, the fires began. Within an hour, a huge tower of smoke caused by the fires could be seen 100 miles away. And for 3 days and nights, this huge fire moved in the sky, reddening the sun, darkening the day, and filling the land with smoke. There was no opposing the flames. There was no organization, no communication. The earthquake had smashed all the modern inventions of a 20th century city. The streets were broken and filled with pieces of fallen walls. The telephone and telegraph systems were broken. And the great water pipes had burst. All inventions and safety plans of man had been destroyed by 30 seconds of movement by the earth. By Wednesday afternoon, only 12 hours after the earthquake, half the heart of the city was gone. I watched the huge fire. It was very calm. There was no wind, yet from every side, wind was pouring in upon the city. East, west, north, and south, strong winds were blowing upon the dying city. The heated air made a huge wind that pulled air into the fire, rising into the atmosphere. Day and night, the calm continued, and yet, near the flames, the wind was often as strong as a storm.
There was no water to fight the fire. Firefighters decided to use explosives to destroy buildings in its path. They hoped this would create a block to slow or stop the fire. Building after building was destroyed. And still the great fires continued. Jack London told how people tried to save some of their possessions from the fire.
Wednesday night, the whole city crashed and roared into ruin, yet the city was quiet. There were no crowds. There was no shouting and yelling. There was no disorder. I passed Wednesday night in the path of the fire. In all those terrible hours, I saw not one woman who cried, not one man who was excited, not one person who caused trouble. Throughout the night, tens of thousands of homeless ones fled the fire. Some were wrapped in blankets. Others carried bedding and dear household treasures. Many of the poor left their homes with everything they could carry. Many of their loads were extremely heavy. Throughout the night, they dropped items they could no longer hold. They left on the street clothing and treasures they had carried for miles. Many carried large boxes called trunks. They held on to these the longest. It was a hard night, and the hills of San Francisco are steep, and up these hills, mile after mile, were the trunks dragged. Many a strong man broke his heart that night. Before the march of the fire were soldiers. Their job was to keep the people moving away from the fire. The extremely tired people would arise and struggle up the steep hills, pausing from weakness every 5 or 10 feet. Often, after reaching the top of a heartbreaking hill, they would find the fire was moving at them from a different direction. After working hour after hour through the night to save part of their lives, thousands were forced to leave their trunks and flee. At night, I walked down through the very heart of the city. I walked through mile after mile of beautiful buildings. Here was no fire. All was in perfect order. The police patrolled the streets, and yet it was all doomed, all of it. There was no water. The explosives were almost used up, and two huge fires were coming toward this part of the city from different directions. 4 hours later, I walked through this same part of the city. Everything still stood as before, and yet there was a change. A rain of ashes was falling. The police had been withdrawn. There were no firemen, no fire engines, and no men using explosives. I stood at the corner of Kearney and Market Streets in the very heart of San Francisco. Nothing could be done. Nothing could be saved. The surrender was complete. It was impossible to guess where the fire would move next. In the early evening, I passed through Union Square. It was packed with refugees. Thousands of them had gone to bed on the grass. Government tents had been set up, food was being cooked, and the refugees were lining up for free meals. Late that night, I passed Union Square again. Three sides of the square were in flames. The square with mountains of trunks was deserted. The troops, refugees, and all had retreated. The next morning, I sat in front of a home on San Francisco's famous Knob Hill. With me sat Japanese, Italians, Chinese, and Negroes. All about were the huge homes of the very rich. To the east and south of us were advancing two huge walls of fire. I went inside one house and talked to the owner. He smiled and said the earthquake had destroyed everything he owned. All he had left was his beautiful house. He looked at me and said, "The fire will be here in 15 minutes." Outside the house, the troops were falling back and forcing the refugees ahead of them. From every side came the roaring of flames, the crashing of walls, and the sound of explosives. Day was trying to dawn through the heavy smoke. A sickly light was creeping over the face of things. When the sun broke through the smoke, it was blood red and small. The smoke changed color from red to rose to purple. I walked past the broken dome of the city hall building. This part of the city was already a waste of smoking ruins. Here and there through the smoke came a few men and women. It was like the meeting of a few survivors the day after the world ended.
The huge fires continued to burn on. Nothing could stop them. Mr. London walked from place to place in the city, watching the huge fires destroy the city. Nothing could be done to halt the firestorm. In the end, the fire went out by itself because there was nothing left to burn. Jack London finishes his story.
All day Thursday and all Thursday night, all day Friday and Friday night, the flames raged on. Friday night saw the huge fires finally conquered, but not before the fires had swept 3/4 of a mile of docks and storehouses on the waterfront. San Francisco at the present time is like the center of a volcano. Around this volcano are tens of thousands of refugees. All the surrounding cities and towns are jammed with the homeless ones. The refugees were carried free by the railroads to any place they wished to go. It is said that more than 100,000 people have left the peninsula on which San Francisco stood. The government has control of the situation, and thanks to the immediate relief given by the whole United States, there is no lack of food. The bankers and businessmen have already begun making the necessary plans to rebuild this once beautiful city of San Francisco.
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.